It is Thursday, October 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Barack Obama is expected to announce he will slow the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan. We'll look at the implications.
I mean, obviously, the fall of Kunduz was quite a stunning blow to the claims that these forces are able to defend Afghanistan against the resurgent Taliban.
Myanmar signs a peace deal with some rebel groups, and internationally renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma celebrates his 60th birthday by releasing a new recording. It's all ahead. U.S. President Barack Obama is expected to announce Thursday that he will slow down the planned withdrawal of American military forces from Afghanistan, scheduled for next year. An unnamed senior administration official says the president will maintain the current number of troops in the country at 9,800 through most of 2016, before trimming that number to 5,500 by the time he leaves office in January of 2017. I'm joined by reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan. Ayaz, later today, U.S. President Barack Obama is expected to announce that the U.S. will be stopping its military withdrawal from Afghanistan and keep thousands of troops in the country through the end of Mr. Obama's term in 2017. Possibly, could this have been inspired by some of the recent violence in Afghanistan, particularly since just a few weeks ago, the Taliban occupied the northern city of Kunduz?
Yeah, we have seen a lot of insurgent activity in recent weeks, and especially the brief takeover of this northern city of Kunduz by the Taliban. And then we have seen fighting elsewhere in the country, and we have seen that the Taliban have inflicted heavy casualties on Afghan security forces. So all this activity has obviously raised questions about the preparedness of Afghan security forces. I mean, obviously, the fall of Kunduz was quite a stunning blow to the claims that these forces are able to defend Afghanistan against the resurgent Taliban. So this has led to now a widespread debate within Afghanistan, and we see also among the U.S.-led NATO partners, whether there's a need for keeping more troops than President Obama has originally planned, like by 2016, confining the U.S. military presence just to the embassy in Kabul. But obviously, the debate is now focusing on whether there's a need for a larger presence of U.S. and NATO forces in the country. And this debate also stems from recent President Ashraf Ghani's request to the NATO alliance that he would need more support for more years from the international military coalition. And we saw that Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah, when he was representing Afghanistan in the recent UN General Assembly session, in his speech, he also indirectly suggested that it will be helpful for the Afghan security forces to have the support of international forces for a longer period. So all this has been, you know, debated, and we saw today that the Taliban has finally come out and reacted to this debate and warning that any continuation of, according to them, foreign occupation forces in Afghanistan will prolong the conflict and will not help in resolving the Afghan issue. And the Taliban has once again reiterated that they are willing to hold negotiations to seek a peaceful settlement of the Afghan conflict, provided all foreign troops are withdrawn from the country and, according to the Taliban, an Islamic government is established in Afghanistan and that foreign interference is ended in the internal affairs of Afghanistan. So their willingness to re-engage in negotiations, as the Taliban says, all concerned sides, clearly shows that they are also willing to now come back to the negotiating table rather than, continuing the fight. Obviously, they are also exhausted and tired of this prolonged conflict in Afghanistan. But let me just tell you one interesting aspect of the statement that we have received from the Taliban's media wing today. It does not clearly say whether the Taliban would want to resume negotiations with the Afghan government from where they were broken off in late July, when it was disclosed that the Taliban supreme leader Mullah Omar had actually died 2 years ago. In the statement, the Taliban has severely criticized the government in Kabul for seeking foreign military presence extension in the country and for not being a popular government. So this indicates that the Taliban is willing to hold negotiations, but whether it wants to sit down on the table with the Afghan government, with the current Afghan government, is not clear. And we have seen that both sides have lately criticized severely each other. For the Taliban were criticized by the Kabul government for committing alleged human rights violations and abuses during their brief occupation of Kunduz. And the Taliban has been critical of President Ashraf Ghani's government for what they say launching a campaign to malign the Islamic group. So this has obviously increased the gap between the two sides.
Yes, because some of the things that the Taliban are calling for, you know, the withdrawal of all foreign troops, that doesn't sound, particularly after what Mr. Obama is expected to say today, that's not going to be happening. And then, you know, the installation of an Islamic government, I would think the Afghan government considers itself an Islamic government.
That's absolutely right, because the Taliban, from their actions, have established that if there is no foreign military support to the Afghan government, things could really become chaotic and problematic, not only for the current government in Afghanistan, but for the international community in terms of controlling the extremist wave that has plagued this region. And secondly, President Ashraf Ghani has repeatedly said that the constitution of Afghanistan is an Islamic constitution, and whatever political setup is in place in Kabul is also there according to Islamic law.
Okay, thank you very much, Ayaz. That's Ayaz Gul reporting from Islamabad, Pakistan.
Thank you, Zara.
Well, International Edition Susan Yaki joins me now here in the studio with a look at what's on social media right now.
Hi, Sarah. As we've been reporting, Myanmar's government and eight armed ethnic groups have signed a ceasefire agreement that is being hailed by officials as a major achievement, even though several other rebel armies refused to sign the deal. On Twitter, Christian Today says, "Peace in Myanmar edges closer." Veronica Pedrosa's tweet says, "Okay, it's a deal, but whether it brings peace is a different matter altogether." Rajaskar Reddy says on Facebook, "Myanmar has been engaged in an armed conflict with various ethnic rebel groups seeking greater autonomy since independence from the British in 1948.
And Susan, what about in our social media today?
Well, at the voanews.com website, our lead story is the possible change of the U.S. posture on Afghanistan, which you've just been reporting on. But it also says Russian leader Putin has said the U.S. stance on Syria is unconstructive. And it notes the U.S. has strongly criticized Russia's military campaign in Syria. In sports, there is an article on the captain of Nepal's football team, that's soccer for Americans, and four teammates being arrested on charges of accepting money to fix matches. And before I go, I want to wish everyone a very happy global hand-washing today. Hand-washing Day. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention writes, "It is a way to support a global and local culture at hand-washing with soap, shine a spotlight on the state of hand washing in each country, and raise awareness about the benefits of hand washing with soap. It encourages school children, teachers, and families to get involved. It notes hand washing is not only simple and inexpensive, but hand washing with soap can dramatically cut the number of young children who get sick." New Devon CCG tweets, "Hand washing is one of the simplest ways of preventing illness such as food poisoning and flu." Krillian tweets in a musical bent, "Wash, wash, wash your hands, wash it every day." And Kalsam Shambalak tweets, "If you did it all year round, you wouldn't need to allocate a whole 24 hours to get it all off." You can join in the fun at hashtag Global Handwashing Day. Sarah?
Yeah, I got to remember to wash those hands. Well, that's International Edition's Susan Yaki. In other news, as Susan mentioned, Myanmar on Thursday signed a ceasefire agreement with eight armed groups, but other significant rebels fighting the government refused to sign the pact. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
At a signing ceremony in Myanmar's capital, Naypyidaw, President Thein Sein hailed the national ceasefire agreement as a historic gift for future generations. Tens of thousands of troops from both sides have lost their lives in the conflicts, the president notes. Hundreds of thousands of people living in conflict areas have suffered severely due to the fighting. Acknowledging that the ethnic Kachin and Hua, with tens of thousands of soldiers, are still determined to fight, the president pledged to try harder to gain agreement with other groups. About 40% of the population of Myanmar, also known as Burma, are members of ethnic groups, many of them with long-standing demands for control over natural resources in their territories. At the ceremony, the chief of the Karen National Union, Samutu Sepo, offered some advice to Myanmar's powerful military. He requests the military to use dialogue rather than force to persuade other groups to put down their weapons. The KNU is arguably the most significant signatory and has been fighting the military for 60 years. Under terms of the ceasefire, which does not require disarmament, political dialogue is to commence within 90 days. It took 2 years of negotiations to bring the 8 rebel groups on board. Those who signed on to the pact are primarily clustered along Myanmar's border with Thailand. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Marine ecologists from Australia's University of Adelaide recently conducted a study that predicts a disturbing future for the ocean's food chain. Their study indicated that rising ocean acidification and warming linked to climate change will probably cause a drop in the number and variety of important species that support marine ecosystems throughout the world. According to the study, larger fish that sit atop the ocean's food chain would probably be among the aquatic creatures most affected by this possible breakdown. These are also some of the key species that support the world's fishing industry. The analysis also showed that increasing acidification would lead to a drop in ocean plankton's production of dimethyl sulfide gas. This gas plays a role in Earth's climate by controlling the Earth's heat exchange between the ocean and atmosphere. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, cellist Yo-Yo Ma has a musical celebration of his 60th birthday. The trade agreement recently reached between the United States and 11 other countries around the Pacific Rim has been in the works since 2008. And if approved by each country's government, will unite 40% of the global economy. But the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, has become controversial, especially in the United States, as opponents warn of job losses and other negative consequences. From New York, VOA's Bernard Schussman has more on the pros and cons surrounding the trade accord.
This Texas demonstration is typical of the hostility that exists over the TPP. Unions call it a job sellout. They believe that not only will no new jobs be created, but that the pact will cause people to lose their jobs while lowering salaries for those who are able to keep them. But that's not the only objection to the agreement. In June, Congress approved what is called fast-track trade authority. That means the TPP cannot be amended by U.S. lawmakers. Congress will only be able to give a quick up or down vote on the agreement. And the final say on any controversy between nations will be decided by a 3-person panel. Former IBM official and now a professor of NYU's Stern School of Business, Ralph Gomery.
So we've already had 3 decades of similar treaties, each one a little more expansive and a little bit worse, right? And we don't have to ask, what will the impact on this country be? We just can look backwards, okay? And this country, its manufacturing base has been hollowed out. Those jobs and those technologies and those factories have gone overseas.
But for big business and multinational corporations, it's a completely different story. It's an opportunity to develop new markets and increase sales of products that will generate profits and improve shareholder value. Peter Cardillo, the chief market analyst for Rockwell Global, says it will help economic growth and domestic workers.
But you know, like every treaty, it has its ups and downs, and of course it has its pluses and minuses, and there are those who are going to try to fight it because they're going to think that jobs are going to go abroad, and there are those who are going to think, well, no, it's going to be really good for the economy. I lie somewhere in between.
But Peter Costa, president of the Wall Street firm Empire Executions, says the U.S. and its workers are once again getting the short end of the treaty stick.
I think it favors smaller trading partners, other trading partners on the rim, and I think the U.S. is, like usual, signing a contract that, you know, in the end, we may not benefit from totally. I think the U.S. might have some difficulty ratifying, but in the end, it more than likely will pass.
The complete text of the TPP agreement is expected to be released in coming weeks. Under a timetable laid out by the U.S. Congress, President Barack Obama can sign the deal 60 days after the text is made public. Bernard Schussman, VOA News, New York.
This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma celebrated his 60th birthday this month, and he has a new CD that takes a musical, contemplative look at life. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, Ma has teamed with longtime piano collaborator Catherine Scott to produce a recording that takes listeners on an emotional journey.
There are few accolades that Yo-Yo Ma has not received in his storied career. A multiple Grammy winner, Ma has also been a Kennedy Center honoree, has been awarded the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom, and has won the U.S. National Medal of Arts. On his new CD, Songs from the Arc of Life, the cellist uses classical pieces by Bach, Debussy, Tchaikovsky, and others to take listeners through several emotional ages. Ma says his intent was to record a soundtrack for life's most important moments.
Everybody goes through hard times, good times, and when you go through any one of those times, extreme moments, there's usually some music associated with it. You know, first date, first kiss, you know. It's like moments where, or grief, first loss. And so we kind of compiled something that goes from beginning to end, and to acknowledge that no matter how focused we are at any moment in our lives, that it is part of a larger whole, and how in the end do we want that life to be.
The cellist says that turning 60 is an important milestone for him, but it also gives him the freedom to be who he really is and not someone that other people want him to be.
I don't live compartments. I'm basically always myself. You know, it's not like, okay, I have to be really polite or I have to do this. No, I'll just say what I think is true and do what I think is right and not worry about, you know, someone saying, well, that's stupid. You know, because, okay, if you think it's stupid, it's stupid. You know, I can't help it. You know, it's like,
I'm just going to try and do my best.
Yo-Yo Ma has been playing the cello since he was only four. His parents were both musical. His mother was a singer and his father a violinist and professor of music. Despite the exacting demands of playing the classical repertoire, Yo-Yo Ma says that he actually finds serenity in playing, even the difficult pieces.
So I view sort of performing like the moments before you fall asleep or right when you wake up, and you're sort of half, you're half dreaming, half awake, and you have these great ideas that come to your mind and you try and write them down, because if you don't, you forget them because you have temporary access. And having that access puts you in this very, very wonderful state.
Yo-Yo Ma and Catherine Scott will perform in Japan and Taiwan in October and November in support of the new CD. U.S. stops on their tour include the Palladium in Carmel, Indiana, and Boston's Symphony Hall. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
And that is the music of Yo-Yo Ma. How beautiful. I think I'm going to get that CD. Well, that's our show for today. Please look at our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
October 16th is World Food Day, a day of action against hunger. The date commemorates the founding in 1945 of the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, or FAO. On this day, people around the world come together to declare their commitment to eradicate hunger in our lifetime. Over the past decade or so, we have seen a great reduction of people living with hunger on a nearly daily basis. Back then, about 1 in 6 people went to bed hungry most nights. Now it's about 1 in every 9. Nonetheless, that still leaves some 795,000 chronically hungry people around the world. Of these, 60% are women, and this despite the fact that most small farmers living in the developing world are women. And when women go hungry, so all too often do children. About 161 million kids under the age of 5 are malnourished. This means that their brains won't develop normally, they may have difficulties learning, and their physical and cognitive growth is stunted. Lack of nutrition compromises not only their own success in the future, but also the development of the communities, economies, and countries in which they live. In addition to those children who are chronically undernourished, almost 5 million children under the age of 5 die of malnutrition-related causes every year. The global community is working to eradicate hunger because it is the right thing to do. The first of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals called for halving the proportion of people suffering from hunger and facing extreme poverty. We have achieved that goal. As we transition to a sustainable development agenda for 2030, we have raised our ambitions and are striving to effectively end hunger and extreme poverty altogether. The United States aids this effort through its innovative Feed the Future initiative. We partner with country governments, many universities, multilateral and non-governmental organizations, transnational organizations like the UN, research communities, and the private sector to lift millions of vulnerable people out of hunger and poverty. On World Food Day, the United States reaffirms its commitment to the fight against poverty, hunger, and undernutrition.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.